If Raymond had ever prosecuted Laron Little or let somebody else do it, he could have just as well resigned as run for re-election. But I don't mention that. Disgust has finally displaced some of my anger. I stand up to leave. "Rusty," he says to me, "I meant what I said. I want to help you. You give me the high sign and I'll do whatever you want. You want me to kiss Augie Bolcaro's ass in Wentham Square at noon so he'll make you a judge? I'll do it. You want to work for the big bucks? I'll try to arrange that too. I know. I owe you." What he means is that he wants to keep me happy, now more than ever. But his genuflection is still soothing in a way. You cannot continue pounding a man who's on his knees. I say nothing. But I nod. On the way to the door, Raymond again points out all the modern art along the walls. He apparently has forgotten that he gave the same dime lecture to Stern and me. As we're parting by the elevator, he reaches for me and tries to take me into an embrace. "It was a terrible thing," he says. I break away. I actually shove him slightly. But there are people around, and Horgan pretends not to have noticed. The elevator arrives. Horgan snaps his fingers. Something has come to mind. "You know," he says quietly, "there was one thing I promised myself I was going to ask you today." "What's that, Raymond?" I ask as I step inside. "Who killed her? I mean, who do you think?" I say nothing. I remain impassive. Then, as the elevator doors begin to close, I nod to Raymond Horgan in a gentlemanly way. Chapter 38. One day in October, I am working in the yard and I feel an odd stirring. I am fixing the fence, removing the posts, sinking new ones in cement, nailing on the beef tail. For a moment I consider the tool with which I am working, a whatchamacallit. It is an inheritance of sorts from my father-in-law. After his death, Barbara's mother brought all his yard and home equipment over here. The whatchamacallit is a piece of black iron, a cross between a hammer's claw and a crowbar. You can use it for anything. On the night of April 1st, it was used to kill Carolyn Polhemus. Right after the trial, I noticed that there was still a crust of blood and one blonde hair clinging to the edge of one of the two teeth. I stared at the whatchamacallit for a long time, and then I took it to the basement and washed it in the laundry tub. Barbara came downstairs as I was doing it. She stopped dead on the stairway when she saw me, but I tried to appear jovial. I reached for the hot water and began to whistle. I have picked it up several times since then. I want to observe no fetishes, no taboos. And after a moment for reflection, I decide it is not the whatchamacallit singing to me like a ghost. Instead, as I consider the grass, the roses and their thorns, the vegetable bed that I helped Barbara put in this spring, there is the sense of something in this house, this land, that is irretrievably used up and old. I am finally ready for some considered changes. I find Barbara in the dining room, where she is grading papers. They are stacked across the table like my mother's magazines and note cards from her era as a radio personality. I sit down on the other side. "We should think about moving back into the city," I tell her. I expect, of course, that this concession will bring from Barbara a radiance of victory. She has advocated the move for many years. Instead, Barbara puts down her pen and holds her forehead. She says, "Oh, God." I wait. I know something awful is going to happen. I am not scared. "I didn't want to talk about this yet, Rusty." "What?" "The future," she says, and adds, "I didn't think that it would be fair to you so soon." "All right," I say. "You've nodded in the direction of good taste. Why don't you tell me what's on your mind?"
"Rusty, don't be like that."
"I'm like that. I'd like to hear." She folds her hands.
"I've taken a job for the January term at Wayne State.
Wayne State is not in Kendall County. Wayne State is not within 400 miles of here. Wayne State, as I recall, is in a city I have visited once, which is called Detroit. Detroit, right?
Right, she says.
You're leaving me?
I wouldn't put it like that. I'm taking a job.
Rusty, I hate to do this to you now, but I feel I have to. They've hired me for the September term. I was going to tell you in April, but then all that craziness began. She shivers her head with her eyes closed. Anyway, they were nice enough to give me an extension. I've changed my mind half a dozen times, but I've decided it's for the best. Where's Nat going to be?
With me, of course,
she answers, her look suddenly fierce and aquiline. On this point, she means to say there must not even be a thought that she might yield. It occurs to me as a sort of reflex that I could probably go to court and try to prevent that. But just now I have had enough of litigation. In its odd way, the thought inspires a smile, rueful and brief, a reaction which brings a vaguely hopeful look to Barbara.
What do you mean you're not leaving me? You're taking a job? I ask.
Am I invited to Detroit?
Would you come?
I might. This isn't a bad time for me to start over. There are a few unpleasant things following me around here. Barbara immediately tries to correct me. She has thought all of this through, perhaps to salve her conscience, probably because there are always these geometries in her head.
You're a hero, Barbara says.
They wrote about you in the New York Times, in the Washington Post. I've been expecting you to tell me any day that you're going to run for office. I laugh out loud. But this is a sad remark. More than anything Barbara has said, it proves how far we have already drifted. We have again ceased communication. I have not told her enough for her to understand my own thoroughgoing revulsion with what has gone on in the interest of politics.
Would it offend you if I moved somewhere closer than here so that I can see my son?
Granting that we're not about to live in the same house. She looks at me.
No, she says. I consider the wall for a moment. My God, I think, what happens in a life? And then I think once more of how all this began, and pine, as I have so often lately. Oh, Carolyn, I think, what did I want with you? What did I do? But it is not as if I am entirely without an account. I am nearly 40 now. I can no longer pretend that the world is unknown to me or that I like most of what I've seen. I am my father's son. That is my inheritance, the grimness of outlook bred of knowing that there is more cruelty in life than simple wits can comprehend. I do not claim that my own sufferings have been legion, but I have seen so much. I saw my father's hobbled soul maimed by one of history's great crimes. I saw the torment and the need, the random and passionate anger that brings such varied and horrible misbehavior to our own streets. As a prosecutor, I meant to combat it, to declare myself a sworn enemy of the crippled spirit that commits each trespass with force and arms. But, of course, it overcame me. Who can observe that panorama of negative capacity and maintain any sense of optimism? It would be easier if the world were not so full of casual misfortune. Golan Scharf, a neighbor, has a son born blind. Mac and her husband, in a moment of revelry, turn a corner and plunge into the river. And even if luck, and luck alone, spares us the worst, life nonetheless wears so many of us down. Young men of talent dull it and drink it all away. Young women of spirit bear children, broaden in the hips and shrink in hope as middle years close in upon them. Every life, like every snowflake, seemed to me then unique in the shape of its miseries and in the rarity and mildness of its pleasures. The lights go out. grow dim, and a soul can stand only so much darkness. I reached for Carolyn, with all deliberation and intent. I cannot pretend it was an accident or serendipity. It was what I wanted. It was what I wanted to do. I reached for Carolyn. And so, now, still gazing at the wall, I begin to speak, saying aloud things that I had promised myself would never be spoken. I've thought a lot about the reasons, I say. Not that anyone can fully comprehend them. Whatever you call that insane mix of rage and lunacy that leads one human being to kill another, it's not the kind of thing that's easy to understand in any ultimate way. I doubt anybody, not the person who does it or anyone else, can really grasp the whole thing. But I've tried. I really have tried. I mean, one thing I should say to start, Barbara, is that I apologize to you. I think a lot of people would find that laughable, that I would say that, but I do. And one more thing you've got to know. You have to believe it. She was never more important to me than you are. Never. I guess, to be unflinchingly honest, there must have been something there that I didn't believe I could find anywhere else. That was my failing. I admit it. But as you've told me yourself, I was absolutely obsessed with her. It would take hours to explain why. She had that power. I had that weakness. But I know goddamn well that I wouldn't have gotten over her for years. And probably never, as long as she was walking around. I mean, there is no such thing as justification here, or excuse. I'm not trying to pretend there is. But at least we should both acknowledge the circumstances. I always figured it wasn't going to do anybody much good to talk about it, and I assumed that was what you'd figured. What happened, happened. But naturally, I've spent a lot of time thinking about exactly how it occurred. I could hardly help that. I guess every prosecutor learns that we live closer than we want to believe to real evil doing. Fantasy is a lot more dangerous than people like to say. You get this idea, this careful, elaborate plan. It becomes actually stimulating to think about it. It titillates and thrills you. You dwell on it, and you take the first step toward carrying it out, and that is thrilling and titillating, too, and you go on. And in the end, once you edge up to it that way, telling yourself all along that no real damage has been done, it takes just one extraordinary moment when you revel in the excitement, in the feeling of flying free for the whole thing actually to occur. I finally look back. Barbara is on her feet now, standing behind her chair. Her look is quick and alarmed, as well it might be. No doubt she never wanted to hear this. But I go on. As I said, I really never thought I'd have to talk about this. But I raise it now because I think once and for all it ought to be said aloud. There's no threat here. There's not even the shadow of a threat, okay? God knows what somebody in your position might think, Barbara. But there is not a threat. I just want the cards on the table. I don't want there to be wondering about what either of us knows or thinks. I don't want that to be a factor in whatever it is we're going to do. Because all in all, even though you're probably amazed to hear me say all of this, and then say this too, I expected, I guess the word is wanted, is want to go on. There are a lot of reasons. Nat, first of all, of course. And I also want to minimize the damage to our lives. But more than that, I do not want that mad act to have had no decent consequence. Basically, in trying to explain to myself
how and why this woman was murdered, for what little rational impulses have to do with it, and for what little they are worth as explanations. I suppose I always thought that in part it was for us. For us. For the good of us. God knows a lot of it was simply for my benefit, if conscience can stand those words. Get even. But I thought some of it was for us, too. And so I wanted to say that, to see if all of this means anything to you or makes any difference. I am finished at last and feel strangely satisfied. I have done as well with this as I ever could have imagined. Barbara, my wife, is crying very hard and silently. She is looking downward while the tears simply fall. She heaves and catches her breath.
Rusty, I don't think there is anything worth saying, except I'm sorry. I hope you believe me someday. I really am so sorry.
I understand, I tell her. I believe you now.
And I was prepared to tell the truth at any time, right up to the end. If I was called as a witness, I would have told what happened.
I understand that, too. But I didn't want that. Frankly, Barbara, it wouldn't have done a bit of good. It would have sounded like some desperate excuse, like you were making a bizarre effort to save me. Nobody ever would have believed that you were the one who killed her. These words bring fresh tears, and then, finally, control. It has been said, and she is, in a measure, relieved. Barbara wipes each eye with the back of her hands. She breathes deeply. She speaks, looking down at the table.
Do you know what it feels like to be crazy, Rusty?
Really crazy? To not be able to get hold of who you are?
You never feel safe. I feel like every step I take, the ground is soft, that I'm going to fall through it. And I can't go on that way. I don't think that I can be a normal person again if I'm living with you. I know how horrible that is. But it's horrible for me, too. No matter what I thought, nobody goes back to the way things used to be after something like this. All I can say, Rusty, is that nothing turned out the way I expected. I never understood the reality of any of it until the trial. Until I sat there. Until I saw what was happening to you. And finally felt how much I didn't want that to be happening. But that's part of what I can't get over. I have no life here, except being sorry and afraid. And of course, ashamed is not the word. Guilty? She shakes her head slowly, looking down at the table. There isn't a word.
We could try to share that, you know. The blame, I say. Somehow, in spite of myself, this remark has a whimsical quality. Barbara gasps a bit. She bites her lip suddenly. She looks the other way for a second and, in a momentary exhalation, cries. Then she shakes her head again.
I don't think that's right, she says. The trial came out the way it should have, Rusty.
That's all she says. I might have hoped for more, but it's enough. She starts to leave the room, but stops and lets me hold her for a moment, actually a long moment, as she lingers with me. But finally she breaks away. I hear her go upstairs. I know, Barbara, she will lie on our bed and weep a while longer. And then she is going to get back on her feet and begin packing to leave. Chapter 39. One day, right after Thanksgiving, when I've come to town for Christmas shopping, I see Nico DeLaGuardia walking down Kindle Boulevard. He holds his raincoat drawn closely around the collar, and he has a worried brow. He seems to be looking up and down the street. He is coming in my direction, but I am quite certain he has not seen me yet. I think of ducking into a building, not because I am afraid of his response, or mine, but simply because I think it might be easier for both of us to avoid this meeting. By then, however, he has caught sight of me, and he is heading deliberately my way. He does not smile, but he offers his hand first, and I take it. For that instant only, I am rifled by a shot of terrible emotion, hot pain and grief. But it quickly passes, and I stand there, looking affably at the man who, in any practical sense, tried to take my life from me. One person, a man in a felt hat, apparently aware of the momentousness of the meeting, turns to stare as he continues on his way, but otherwise the pedestrian traffic merely divides about us. Nico asks me how I am. He has the earnest tone people lately have tended to adopt, so I know that he has heard. I tell him anyway. "Barbara and I split up," I say.
"I heard that," he says.
"I'm sorry, I really am. Divorce is a bitch. Well, you know, you had me crying on your shoulder, and I didn't have the kid. Maybe you guys can work it out." "I doubt that. Nat's with me for the time being, but only until Barbara gets settled in Detroit."
"Too bad," he says. "Really, too bad."
Old Nico, I think, still repeating everything. I turn to let him go on his way. I offer my hand first this time. And when he takes it, he steps closer and squeezes up his face so that I know that what he is about to say is something he finds painful.
"I didn't set you up," he says. "I know what people think, but I didn't have anybody screw with the evidence. Not Tommy, not Kumagai."
I almost wince at the thought of Painless. He has resigned now from the police department. He had no refuge. He could only claim collusion or incompetence, and so he chose the lesser, and I believe more apt, of the two evils. He did not botch the semen specimen, of course, but I've come to believe that no one would have been indicted if he'd looked back at his autopsy notes. Nobody could have put it all together. Maybe Tommy's also to blame for pushing too hard to bring a marginal case. I suppose he thought my hide would still his grief or envy, whatever state it was that Carolyn had left him in, which so riled his passions. Nico, in the meantime, continues, sincere as ever.
"I really didn't," he says. "I know what you think, but I have to tell you that. I didn't do that."
"I know you didn't, DeLay," I say. And then I tell him what I think is the truth. "You did your job the way you thought you were supposed to. You just relied on the wrong people." He watches me. "Well, it's probably not going to be my job much longer. You've heard about this recall thing?" he asks. He is looking up and down the street again.
"Oh, of course you have. Everybody has."
"Well, what's the difference? They all tell me my career is over." He is not looking for sympathy. He just wants me to know that the waves of calamity have spread and washed over him as well. Carolyn has pulled all of us down in her black wake. I find myself encouraging him. "You can't tell, DeLay. You never know how things will turn out." He shakes his head.
"No, no," he says. "No.
You're the hero. I'm the goat. It's great." Nico smiles in a sudden way so that you know he finds his own thoughts weird, inappropriate. "A year ago, you could have beat me in the election, and you could do it today. Isn't that great?" Nico DeLaGuardia laughs out loud, pinched by his own ironies, the peculiar readings from his own terms of reference. He spreads his arms here in the middle of Kindle Boulevard.
"Nothing," he says, "has changed."
Chapter 40. In the front room of the home in which I have lived for better than 8 years, there is complete disorder. Open boxes, half-packed, are everywhere. The items removed from shelves and drawers are strewn in all directions. The furniture is gone. I never cared much for the sofa or the love seat, and Barbara wanted them for her condo outside Detroit. I'll move January 2nd to an apartment in the city. Not a bad place. The realtor said I was lucky to get it. The house is up for rent. I've decided that each step should be slow. Now that Nat has left, the job of packing seems to take forever. I move from room to room. Every item reminds me of something. Each corner seems to contain its quotient of pain and melancholy. When I reach my limit, I start working somewhere else. I think often of my father, and that scene I recalled for Marty Polhemus, in which I found my old man, the week after my mother's death, packing up the apartment he had abandoned a few years before. He worked in a sleeveless undervest, and he had a brazen manner as he pitched the remains of his adult life into crates and boxes. He kicked the cartons from his path as he moved about the rooms. I heard from Marty just last week. He sent a Christmas card. "Glad to hear everything worked out for you." I laughed aloud when I read his message. Lord, that kid really has a knack. I threw the card away. But the toll of loneliness is greater than I imagined. A couple of hours ago, I went rummaging through the boxes of trash in the living room looking for the envelope. I need the address to write him back. I never wrote my father. After he left for Arizona, I did not see him again. I called on occasion, but only because Barbara dialed the number and put the receiver in my hand. He was so deliberately uncommunicative, so chary with the details of his life, that it was never worth the effort. I knew he was living with a woman by then, that he worked 3 days a week in a local bakery. He found Arizona hot. The woman, Wanda, called to tell me he was dead. That was more than 8 years ago now, but the shock of it, in a way, is with me every day. He was strong and fit. I had taken it for granted that he would live to be 100, that there would always be this far-off target for my bitterness. He had already been cremated. Wanda only found my number as she was cleaning out the trailer, and she insisted I come west to settle the rest of his affairs. Barbara was 8 months pregnant then, and we both regarded this trip west as my father's final imposition. Wanda, it turned out, was from New York City, in her late 50s, tall, not bad-looking. She did not hesitate to speak ill of the dead. Actually, she told me when I arrived, she had moved out on him 6 months before. They called her from the bakery where he collapsed with the coronary, because they knew no one else. "I don't know why I do these things. Really, I have to tell you," she said after a couple of drinks. "He was mostly a prick." She did not think it was funny when I suggested her phrase was what should be carved on the stone. She left me alone to pick through the trailer. On his bed were red socks. In the chiffrobe, I found another 6 or 7 dozen pairs of men's hose, red and yellow, striped, dotted, argyles. In his last years, my father had finally found an indulgence. The doorbell rings. I feel the faintest surge of anticipation. I look forward to a moment's conversation with the postal carrier or the man from UPS. "Lip," I say through the storm door. He enters and stomps the snow off his feet. "Nice and homey," Lip says, surveying the disaster in the living room. As he stands on the doormat, he hands me a small package, not much wider than the satin bow on top. "Christmas present," he says. "That's awfully nice," I say. "We've never done this before. I figured you could use a pick-me-up. Nat get off okay?" I nod. I took him to the airport yesterday. They allowed him to be seated first. I wanted to go with him onto the plane, but Nat would not permit it. From the doorway, I watched him go down the jetway in his dark blue NFL parka, alone and already lost in dreams. He is his father's son. He did not turn to wave. "I want," I thought quite distinctly, "I want the life I had." Lip and I spend a moment looking at each other. I still have not taken his coat. God, it is awkward. And it is like this with everyone, people on the street or people I know well. So much has happened to me that I never counted on. And how are people to respond? Somehow it does not fit into any recognized conversational pattern to say, "It's tough about your wife, but at least they didn't get you for that murder." I finally offer him a beer. "If you're drinking," he answers and follows me to the kitchen. Here, too, half the housewares are in boxes. As I am taking a glass out of the cabinet, LaPranzer points to the package he brought, which I've set down on the table. "I want to see you open that." "I've been saving it a while." He has done a careful job with the paper. "I never saw a gift wrapped before," I say, "with hospital corners." Crumpled inside a small white box is a manila envelope ribboned with red and white evidence tape. I tear through that and find the glass that turned up missing during the trial, the tumbler from Carolyn's bar. I put it all down on the table and take a step away. This is one guess where I would never have been close. Lip fishes in his pocket and comes out with his lighter. He holds a corner of the evidence envelope in the flame until he's sure it's burning, then flips it into the sink. The glass he hands to me. The blue ninhydrin powder is still all over it, the three partial prints etched there, a kind of surrealistic Delft. I hold the glass up to the window light for a moment, trying for reasons I cannot discern to figure which of the tiny networks of lines are the marks of my right thumb and my third right middle finger, the former telltale signs. I am still looking at the glass when I start talking to LaPranzer. "There's a genuine question here whether I should be touched," I say, and now finally catch his eye, or real pissed off. "How that?" "It's a felony in this state to secrete evidence of a crime. You hung your ass out a good long way on this one, Lipper." "No one around who will ever know." Lip pours the beer that I've just opened. "Besides, I didn't do a goddamn thing. It was them that fucked up. Remember they got Schmidt to come grab all the evidence? The glass wasn't there. I took the thing down to Dickerman. Next day I get a call from the lab. The test is done. I can come pick up my glass. When I get down there, somebody signed the receipt returned to evidence. You know, the idea is that I'll put it back in. Only I don't got any way to put it anywhere since it's not my goddamn case anymore. So I tossed it in a drawer. Figured sooner or later somebody's got to ask me. Nobody did. In the meantime, Molto's like every other half-assed deputy, signs off on all the receipts without matching them against the evidence. 3 months later, he's got himself in a bucket of shit. But that's his problem." Lip lifts his glass and drains most of it. "None of them ever had the most screwed-up idea where the thing went. They tell stories about the way Nico tore his office apart. He had him pick up the tacked-down carpet, I hear." We laugh, both of us, knowing Nico. When he gets very excited, you can see his scalp redden where the hair has thinned. His freckles seem to stand out more as well. After the laughter is done, we wait through a little hollow moment of silence. "You know why I'm pissed, don't you?" I finally ask. Lip shrugs and raises his beer. "You thought I killed her," I say. He's prepared for this and does not even flinch. He belches before he answers. "Lady was bad news." "Which makes it okay if I killed her?" "Did you?" asks Lip. That, of course, is what he's come to find out. If he just wanted to be a soul brother, he'd have taken the glass with him the last time he went fishing and dropped it in the Crown Falls, which rages so magnificently up there near Skagen. But it must be eating at him. That's why he's offered the glass, so I know that we're in it together. "You think I did, don't you?" He drinks his beer. "It's passable." "Screw off. You gonna stick your neck out like that because it's just a little possibility, like life on Mars?" Lip looks straight at me, his eyes clear and gray. "I'm not wearing a wire, you know." "I wouldn't care if you were. I've been tried and acquitted. Double jeopardy clause says that's all she wrote. I could publish my confession in the Trib tomorrow, and nobody could try me again for murder. Only we both know, Lip. I take a slug of the beer I've opened for myself. They never do admit it, do they? Lip looks across the kitchen towards something that isn't there.
Forget it,
he says. I'm not going to forget it. Just tell me what you think, okay? You think I cooled her. That's not just for the sporting life that a 15-year copper hikes the evidence in the biggest case in town, right? Right. It ain't just sportin' life. My friend Dan LaPranzer looks at me. I think you killed her.
How?
I mean, you must have worked it out in your head. He does not hesitate as long as I would have thought. I figure you cracked her in anger. The rest was just to make it look good. There wouldn't be much point in saying you were sorry once she was dead.
And why was I so pissed off?
I don't know. Who knows? She dumped you, right? For Raymond. That's enough to be pissed about.
Slowly, I remove the beer glass from LaPranzer's hand. I can see his apprehension when I do that. He is prepared for me to fling it. Instead, I put it on the kitchen table next to the one he brought, the one they found on Carolyn's bar, the one with my prints. They are identical. Then I go to the cabinet and take down the rest of the set, until there are a dozen glasses standing there in two rows. One, sudsed with beer foam at the head on the left, one, dusted with blue powder at the front of the line next to it. It is a rare moment in which LaPranzer wears none of his hipped-up, wise-guy look. I run the water in the sink, washing down the ashes, then fill the basin with suds. I start talking while I do that. Imagine a woman, Lip, a strange woman, with a very precise mathematical mind, very internal, to herself, angry and depressed. Most of the time she is volcanically pissed, with life, with her husband, with the miserable, sad affair he had in which he gave away everything she wanted. She wanted to be his obsession, and instead he's hung up on this manipulative slut, who anyone but he could see regarded him as sport. This woman, Lip, the wife, is sick in spirit and in the heart, and maybe in the head if we're going to be laying all the cards out on the table. She's mixed up. She is seriously on the fence about this marriage. Some days she's sure she's going to leave him. Some days she wants to stay. Either way, she has to do something. The whole thing's eating at her, destroying her. And either way, she has a wish, a wild secret hope that the woman he was sleeping with could end up dead. When the wife's rage is at a peak, she's ready to abandon her husband, head for open spaces. But there would be no satisfaction in that if the other woman is alive, because the husband, helpless slob that he is, will just go crawling back to her and end up with what his wife thinks he wants. The wife can get even only if the other woman is gone. But, of course, you always hurt the one you love. And in her down mood, she longs for everything they had, to find some way to bring them back to old times. But even in these moods, it seems that life would be better if the other woman were dead. With no choice, he will finally give up his obsession. Maybe then they can recycle things, build on the wreckage. The sink by now is full of suds. The ninhydrin comes off the glass easily, although there is a sulfurous stink when it hits the water. Then I take down a towel and wipe the glass clean. When I am finished, I get a box and begin wrapping up the set. Lip helps. He separates the sheets of newsprint that the movers have provided. He is not talking yet. And so the idea is there, day after day. All the wife thinks about is killing the other woman. Whether she is in the peak of rage or the dungeons of self-pity, there is that thrilling notion. And, of course, as the idea takes hold, there is another twist. The husband must know. When she is raging, when she's on the way out the door, it is a kind of delicious vengeance to think of him bereft and knowing just who left him in that condition.
And in her softer moods, when the thought is of somehow saving this marriage, she wants him to appreciate this monumental act of commitment and devotion. Her effort at finding the miracle cure. It will have no meaning to him if he thinks it's just an accident. So that becomes part of the compulsion, to kill. And to let him know that she has done it. How is that to be accomplished? It's a magnificent puzzle to a woman capable of the most intricate levels of complex thought. Obviously, she can't just tell him. For one thing, half the time she's planning to be gone. And, of course, on the basic level, there is a risk that, to put it mildly, her husband might not approve. He may go tattling. She has to take that option from him. And how best to do that? Fortunately, it is predictable that the husband will investigate this crime. The head of the homicide section has taken a powder. The acting head is a person no one trusts. And the husband is the PA's favorite son. He will be the one collecting evidence, him and his pal, the all-star homicide dick, LaPranzer. And as the husband proceeds, detail by detail, he will discover that the culprit for all the world appears to be him. He'll know, of course, that it was not. And he'll know who it was, because there is only one person in the world who has access to this glass, or to his seed. But he'll never convince anybody else of that. He will suffer in lonely silence when she leaves him, or kiss her bloody hand with new devotion when she stays. In the act itself, there will be purification and discovery. With the other woman gone, she will be able to find just what it is she wants to do. But it must be a crime that the rest of the world can reasonably regard as unsolved when hubby declares that to be the case. It must be a crime in which he alone will realize what has occurred. That's why she decides to make it look like a rape. And so the plan proceeds. Something that must be utilized is one of these glasses. I show the tumbler I am wrapping to Lip. He is seated on one of the kitchen chairs now, listening with an open look that mediates between rough horror and a kind of wonder. It was a glass just like this one that her husband picked up and wept over the night he told her of his affair. The self-centered sap sat there and devastated her with the truth, and cried because their glasses were just like the other woman's. That will be the perfect calling card, the perfect way to tell him, you know who. He drinks a beer one night while he watches the ball game. She hides the glass away. Now she has his fingerprints. And then, on a few mornings, she saves the gooey mess that comes out when she removes her diaphragm, puts it in a plastic bag, I figure, which probably sat a while in the basement freezer. And that's how it's done. April 1st. Ha-ha. That's to help him get it. She makes a phone call from the residence an hour before the event. Hubby is at home babysitting. But as Nico would have argued if Stern had ever pointed out that Barbara might have been here when I made that call, you can use the phone in Barbara's study without being heard downstairs. Lyft's chair makes a sudden screech as it jerks back across the floor. Whoa, he says. Run that by again. Who called? Really? Not what DeLay was thinking. Her? Her, I say. That time. That time? That time, not before. You before? Me before. Says Lip, and his eyes dull as he reflects, no doubt, on that day in April when I asked him for what surely seemed a harmless favor, a trivial indiscretion, to skip retrieving my home tolls. He says again, and actually laughs out loud. I do not understand at first, but when I see his somewhat cheerful look, I realize he is satisfied. We can only be who we can be. Detective LaPranzer is pleased to know that he was not completely wrong to judge me guilty of some margin of bad faith. So she called that night. Right. Knowing you'd done it before? I'm not sure of that. She couldn't have overheard me because there was nothing to hear. But if you want to guess, I think she knew. That was my sense. I probably left the phone directory from the PA's office open to the page one time when I called Carolyn. That's the kind of thing Barbara would notice. You know how fixated she is with details, especially around the house. That may even have been what kicked her over the edge. But I don't know for sure. It could have been a coincidence. She had to get in touch with Carolyn somehow. She couldn't just show up. What'd she tell her on the phone? Who knows? Something. Bullshit. She has to drop by. And killed her dead, says Lip. And killed her dead, say I. But not without a stop first at the U. She logged into the computer. Nobody ever checked, but I'll bet she loaded on some brain-busting program. I'd guarantee that machine was churning out paper for 2 hours. Every clever killer needs an alibi, and Barbara, you might say, had considered a detail or two. Then she drives over to Carolyn's, who by now is waiting for her to arrive. Carolyn lets her in, and when she turns her head, Barbara serenely bashes it in with a little item called a whatchamacallit, which is just small enough to fit inside a lady's purse. Then she gets out the cord she's brought along and does some tying, leaves the calling card glass on the bar, and then takes a syringe and the knowledge gained from her readings in artificial insemination, and injects the contents of her little Ziploc bag full of male fluid. She unlocks the doors and windows before she leaves. Of course, criminal detection is a little more complicated than Barbara knew. There are entire fields of inquiry unknown to her, like fiber analysis. She leaves traces she never counted on. The fibers from the carpets in her home, which are clinging to the hem of her skirt. Or a few hairs of her own. Remember how hair and fiber didn't bother with the female hair they picked up at the scene? I'm sure she never figured anybody was going to do so detailed an analysis of the sperm specimen. And I would bet that Barbara had no idea about mud records and was astonished when it turned out that her call was traced back to our phone. She drew more of an arrow toward herself than she intended. Same thing with that third fingerprint on the glass. Probably a moment of carelessness. And, of course, none of us ever figured that Carolyn had tied her tubes. There's the rub, of course. Life, it seems, does not follow the invariable rules of mathematics. Things do not turn out as she had planned. Molto is shadowing the investigation. He picked up on everything she never meant to leave behind, and items like the fingerprints that she had probably figured I could shove under the rug. Things turn very dark for hubby. The world falls in around him. He seems completely fuddled. Maybe he doesn't even know who set him up. And now she finds herself in the one place she never counted on being. She feels sorry for him. He has suffered in ways she never intended. And in the cold light of reality, she is full of shame. She nurses him through his ordeal. She is ready at any moment to save him with the truth, until it fortunately proves unnecessary. But, of course, there are no happy endings. This story is a tragedy. Things are better now between the husband and wife. Passion and feeling have been rediscovered. But now the act stands between them. There are things he cannot say to her, things she cannot say to him. And worst of all, she cannot stand her own guilt or the recollection of her insanity. When I am done, I look at Lip, and Lip looks at me. I ask him if he wants another beer. "No, sir," he says. "I need whiskey." He stands up to wash his glass. Then he puts it in the box with the other 11. He holds the box closed while I apply the tape. I pour him his shot and he stands, drinking. "When'd you figure all this out?" he asks. "The big picture?" "I think I pick up pieces of it every day. There have been days, Lip, while Nat was at school, when I've done nothing but sit in the dark and work over the details. Again and again."
"I mean, when did you know what happened?"
"When did I know she did, Carolyn? Crossed my mind when I heard there was a phone call from here the night she was murdered. But I thought Tommy must have diddled the phone records. I didn't really know until I saw the glasses again in Carolyn's apartment and realized all of hers were there. Lip makes a noise, a little too ironic to be called a groan.
How'd that one make you feel?
Weird. I shake my head. You know, I'd look at her. Here she is, cooking dinner for me, for Nat. Touching me, for Christ's sake.
Then, you know, it would all come clear to me. I was out of my fucking mind. I wouldn't believe it at all. For days, I wouldn't believe it. Sometimes I was positive that Tommy set me up, making me think it was Barbara was part of his scam. I thought that a lot. I would have loved to hear Leon lay it all on Molto. But, you know, at the end, when I knew what it was, I wasn't surprised at all.
Don't you want to see her burn?
I pout my lip. Slowly, I shake my head. I couldn't do it, Lip. I couldn't do it to Nat. We've all had more than enough. I couldn't take it. I don't owe anybody that much.
And you don't worry about the kid? With her?
No, I say. Not that. That's one thing I don't worry about. She's in better shape with him. It pulls her back. Barbara needs someone around who really cares about her. And Nat does. I always knew I couldn't split them up. It would be the worst thing I could do to either one of them.
At least I don't gotta wonder why you threw her out.
Lip makes that noise again.
Phew,
he says. I've sat down now in the kitchen chair Lip formerly occupied. I am thus in the middle of the room, alone as I speak. I'll tell you something that will blow your mind. She's the one who took the powder. I didn't ask her to leave. I suppose 6 months from now I could have woken up and strangled her in her sleep. But I was willing to try it. I really wanted to try. Crazy as she is, wild and nuts, no matter how many times you turn it upside down, you still have to say she did it because of me. Certainly not out of love, but for it. I wouldn't call it even, but we'd have both had our share to make up for. Lip laughs at that.
Boy, he says, you really got away with the ladies.
You think I'd have been out of my mind to stay with her?
You asking my opinion?
I seem to be.
You're better off without her. You're giving her way too much credit. You're believing in a whole lot of accidents.
How's that?
The way you're looking at this whole thing.
For instance,
your prints. They're on the glass, right?
Right.
And only you would know? You can't make an ID yourself. Gotta get the lab to do it. That means somebody else comes up with your name.
Yeah, but I'm a big dummy. I was supposed to recognize the glass, not ask for prints.
In a major murder case, you ain't gonna ask for prints?
I take a moment. Maybe she didn't know they could make a laser match. My prints are there just to keep me from dropping a dime on her.
Sure, says Lip. And in the meantime, the lab is looking at the jism, figuring things out, and they got your carpet fibers.
Nobody ties those things to me.
What about your phone records, if somebody should think to look? You said yourself she probably knew you'd been using this phone to call Carolyn. Why she dial from here while you're around the house? Why take that chance, instead of going to a payphone? You don't think that lady knows from muds or fibers or whose prints are on file after 12 years of listening to your stories?
Lip chucks down the rest of his whiskey.
Champ, you don't got this figured right.
No? Well, what do you figure?
I figure she wanted Carolyn dead and you in the slammer for doing it. I'd say the only thing that happened that she never counted on was that you beat it. Maybe two things.
LaPranza grabs one of the kitchen chairs and sits down astride it. We are now face to face.
I bet she was world-class pissed when you ended up with this case. She'd have never guessed that on the front end. You're the chief deputy. You don't have to horse around these days with homicides. You don't have the time. You got a fucking office to run while Horgan's trying to save his butt. The only thing she'd know is Raymond would be tear-ass. He'd want to keep this thing in-house, right under his thumb. Anybody'd know Raymond would make damn certain the police assignment was special command. I think she figured that some smart homicide dick was going to nail you. Somebody who'd look at too many doors and windows open, who'd get a report about what was in the wad and see it was all a setup. Somebody who'd go looking for a real bright guy who'd know just how to do it. That's what she was counting on. Somebody who knows you real good. Somebody who goes with you to the Red Cross drive and knows your blood type. Maybe even knows you well enough to think you were keeping company with a certain dead lady. Knows what color carpet you got at home.
Lip suddenly and inappropriately yawns as he looks out to the living room.
Yeah, he says. When I come for you with the cuffs, that'd put the knife in pretty deep. That's what I figure.
Lipranzer eyes me sagely. Then he nods, convincing himself.
That's possible, I say, after a moment. I've thought of that.
But she said things didn't go the way she'd expected.
Meaning what? He asks. They didn't fry your ass? I mean, what else you gonna hear but hearts and flowers?
Honey, I'd have saved you if I had to.
What would you do? Say, go ahead and turn me in?
I don't know, Lip. I look at him, then I slug him softly on the shoulder. 15 minutes ago, you thought I was the one who killed her. In response, he makes his sound.
I don't know, I say again. I believe two things. She did it, and she was sorry.
I'll always believe she was sorry. I straighten up. And anyway, it never would have done me any good to tell.
Speaking of telling, did you let your lawyers know at least?
Nope. Neither one. Right at the end, I had this idea Sandy might have figured it out. He talked to me one night about putting Barbara on the stand, and I got a clear feeling he didn't have the slightest interest in really doing it. And the kid, Kemp, had some notion, too. He knew something was out of whack with the phone records. But I'd never have put either one of them in that position, having to choose between my wife and me. I didn't want to be defended that way. Like I said, I couldn't see taking his mother from my son. And besides, it would never wash. If Barbara really figured all this out, Lip, then she knew that too. Nico had a beautiful argument if I got up there and accused her. He would have said this was the perfect crime, an unhappy marriage, a prosecutor who knows the system inside out, a guy who's become a misogynist. He despises Carolyn. He hates his wife, but he loves the boy. If he and his wife split, he'll never get custody. He'd have said, I planned it this way, made it look like her setup, right down to getting her fingerprint on the glass or injecting the spermicide. Maybe he'd say I was using Barbara as a failsafe, the person I'd like to see nabbed in case the whole house of cards fell in on me. There are plenty of juries that might buy that.
But it isn't true, says Lip.
I look at him. I can tell that I have left him out there again, floating uneasily in the nether regions of disbelief.
No, I tell him. That isn't true.
But there is that flicker there, the brief light of an idle doubt. What is harder, knowing the truth or finding it? Telling it or being believed? Closing argument. When Raymond called, I told him the idea was absurd.
Instant rehabilitation, he said.
It is impossible, I answered.
Rusty, he said, give a guilty conscience a chance.
I was not sure if he was referring to himself or everyone in Kendall County, but he insisted it could happen, and at last I told him that if everything could be arranged, I would think seriously about it. In January, as a result of the petition drive, the city council authorized a recall election. Bolcaro could have prevented it, but he displayed a marked neutrality toward DeLaGuardia. Nico campaigned actively to retain his office, and he nearly pulled it out. He fired Tommy Molto with about 2 weeks left, but various civic leaders, including Raymond, Laren, and Judge Mumphrey, came out against him, and DeLaGuardia was recalled with a margin of about 2,000 votes. He has not given up. He is going to run for city council from the South End, and I expect him to win. Bolcaro formed a citizens' commission to make recommendations on the new PA. Raymond was a member. That was what led him to call me. Rumor has it that Mac was the first choice, but she refused to leave the bench. Raymond promised me that the papers had been sounded and that I would receive universal support. I could not think of a good reason to say no. On March 28th, 4 days short of the anniversary of Carolyn Polhemus' murder, I became the acting Kendall County prosecuting attorney. I took the position with the understanding that I will not run for re-election. The mayor has told me a couple of times he thinks I'll make a fine judge, but he has not put that on paper. Right now, I enjoy the job I have. The news stories refer to me as the caretaker PA. My relations with lots of people have all kinds of peculiar strains and edges, but it is no worse at work than when I walk down from my apartment to buy a dozen eggs. I accepted that this would be the case when I did not leave Kendall County. It is not that I am brave, or even stubborn. I just don't think the problems of a new life somewhere else would be any easier than dealing with what is here. I will always be a kind of museum piece. Rusty Sabich, the biggest bullshit thing you've ever seen. Set up, no question about it. And then DeLaGuardia covered Molto. Really pathetic, the whole business. The guy is not quite the same. The murder of Carolyn Polhemus, of course, remains unsolved. No one talks about pursuing it, surely not with me, and it's a practical impossibility anyway to try two people for the same crime. A few months ago, they had some jailhouse crank who was trying to confess. I sent LaPranzer over to take his statement. Lip quickly reported to the department his judgment that it was a bunch of crap. I go to Detroit on many weekends. With this job, it is harder than I planned, but when I cannot make it, Barbara sends Nathaniel down. On my second trip up there, Barbara suggested I stay with them. One thing led to another, and we have, in a sort of half-ass way, been reconciled. She is not likely to come back here. Her job has worked out well, and the truth, I think, is that she enjoys the distance from me and the reminders. Neither of us expects the present arrangement to last. Sooner or later, the swelling will recede, and one of us will meet somebody else. When I think about that, I hope it's a woman a few years younger. I would like to have another child. But that's the kind of thing no one can plan. For the present, Nat seems to take comfort from the fact that his mother and I are still married, not divorced. At times, I admit, I still think of Carolyn. There is none of that crazy longing left, none of the bizarre fixation. I guess she has finally found her place of rest for me. But I puzzle on the experience now and then. What was it, I still think? What was it I wanted with her? What seemed so imperative about it all? In the end, it must have had something to do with my sense of the torment, the agonies which drove her. That legacy of pain was openly displayed in her hard-shell manner, her hipped-up weariness, her ardent courtroom spokesmanship for the likes of Wendell McGaffin, the assailed and woebegone. She was herself someone who had suffered vastly and who claimed in every visible aspect of her being to have triumphed over it all. That was not true. She could no more leave the horrible weight of her past behind than those Greek heroes could fly close to the sun. But does that mean it is impossible for all of us? I reached for Carolyn, and a part of me I knew my gesture was ill-fated. I must have recognized her troubled vanity, the poverty of feeling that reduced her soul. I must have known that what she offered was only the grandest of illusions. But still, I fell for that legend she had made up about herself, the glory, the glamour, the courage, all her determined grace. To fly above this obscure world of anguish, this black universe of pain. For me, there will always be that struggle to escape the darkness. I reached for Carolyn. I adored her, as the faith healer is adored by the halt and lame. But I wanted with wild, wild abandon, with a surging, defiant, emboldened desire, I wanted the extreme. the exultation, the passion, and the moment, the fire, the light. I reached for Carolyn in hope. Hope. Everlasting hope.
This has been an Hachette audio production of Presumed Innocent, written by Scott Turow, read by Edward Herman. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by John McElroy. Recorded by Tommy Herron. Post-production by Gashouse Productions. Presumed Innocent is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1987 by Scott Turow. Audio production copyright 2010 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.